All right. Good evening and welcome. Go around and say hi to, try to do this, Bob in Ellensburg. Is that right? Susan, Tyler, Jim, Jinryu, Mark in Portland, Mark in Aloha. It sounds better than saying like Mark W. Bob in Tigard, Sydney, Coral in Carson, Yeshe, Soki, now Jeff in, are you in Beaverton, Young, Portland, okay, and Jeff Hazen, oh, he didn't stay with us, I think he's probably in Beaverton, all right, Jeff in Portland, Mark in Australia, Marv, Fanuth, Franklin, and Sam. All right. Let's see. For announcements, we are going to have a term student program this fall. So for those of you who aren't familiar with that, that is a approximately 3-month program, which has a beginning retreat and an ending retreat. And during that period of time, you form make some personal vows, and they can be, you know, concrete. They can be, I'm going to sit X number of days a week. I'm going to work on this particular precept. I'm going to read this particular book or something like that. They can be a little more general. I want to work on compassion. I'm going to work on opening my heart, something like that. But they're personalized to you. And at the opening retreat, we share them with each other. And so it's just, you know, the opening and closing retreats are just for the people signed up for the program. So you form a cohort of people. And usually we have about 8 to 10 people signed up. Our retreats are going to be online, so they'll be a little different than they have been in the past, in that we will go into breakout rooms rather than stay in one big group, because that takes longer, and we'd have an 8-hour retreat instead of a 4-hour thing. So we will be doing that. So there's information we'll be going out in a special email probably tomorrow morning. It'll be in the newsletter, and it's on the website. In the very top menu, there's Term Student Program. And so the opening retreat is on September 12th. It's just from 8:30 a.m. until about noon. The closing retreat, I think, is on December 19th or something. And then we're going to have 2 1-day online retreats in between, which aren't required to participate in the Term Student Program, but they're recommended that you incorporate one or two of the, one or both into your term vow. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So September 12th to 7/19, I thought there was a 3-month term student. Is it just a week?
No, I'm sorry. September 12th to December 19th.
December. Okay. I heard it wrong.
I might've said that. I don't know. Yep. Any other questions about that? Cool. Endorsement from Franklin. And it's really great. I mean, you get to know other people as well. One of the things we start off with is essentially telling people our life stories, which for some people is a matter of some trepidation. But you end up sharing your story. I mean, you only have to share what you want to share, but as we can end up practicing side by side or side by side virtually like this for quite a while and not really know much about people in terms of their lives and their history. So that's one of the things that we get to know a little bit more during the term student program. All right. Any other thoughts, any of the stuff that I need to announce, mention? Okay. Okay. So tonight we continue with the book, How to Cook Your Life from the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment by Dogen and Uchiyama Roshi. And tonight we are on chapter 10. And I don't know about you guys, but I don't know, when I first decided that we were going to do this book and I, you know, we scheduled it out and there's 14 chapters. They're really nice and short, actually. But when there were 14 chapters, and I thought for sure that I would get tired of this book before we finished and just quit and do a different book. But I'm finding just every chapter ends up tapping into something different. So I don't know. I'm not finding myself eager to quit the book. You can send me an email if you're eager to quit the book, but let's see. So tonight's chapter is chapter 9, Making Life Calculations. So I'm just going to read a little section from page 66. So it says, on hearing that it is only natural for a violet to bloom as a violet and a rose as a rose, some people immediately begin to wonder about whether they are a rose or a violet. So I can't remember if it's, it must have been in this book somewhere, but this is something that Uchiyama Roshi would say more than once in his teaching. He had a teacher, Kosho Uchiyama, Sawaki Roshi, his teacher, was a very gruff, impressive Zen master kind of guy. And I don't know what Uchiyama was like in comparison, but Uchiyama describes wanting to become like his teacher, wanting to become really impressive and, you know, kind of straightforward and gruff. But at one point his teacher admonished him saying, you know, you can't become me. You know, a violet blooms as a violet, a rose as a rose, or maybe Sawaki didn't say that, but that was Uchiyama's realization. And so in his mind, he was like a violet and his teacher was like a rose, and he wanted to be, you know, become a rose, but the only thing that he could do was blossom as a violet. So we all, you know, we all blossom as we are. And there may be other ways we wish we could blossom, but we can only blossom as we are. And we have to accept whatever it is that we are in order to do that. So that's what he's referring to. So some people immediately begin to wonder whether they are a rose or a violet. Since life is always potential, whether you are a violet or a rose simply is not something that is fixed, nor is it necessary to try to figure it out. What is vital here is that you give expression to the flower of yourself. Self with a capital S, the flower of here and now, and allow it to blossom as completely and as naturally as it can in every moment of your life. That flower of your capital S self, that flower of here and now is your life. So he says again, you have to be careful not to interpret capital S self to mean a kind of self-centeredness or false individualism. As I have mentioned earlier, in Buddhism, your true capital S self includes the world you live in. In this same way, living now does not mean a directionless living for the moment. In Buddhism, the present includes both past and future. To express it in simpler terms, I am speaking of a presence which contains direction, wherein you prepare tomorrow's gruel tonight. It is not a present which relies on tomorrow's happiness. Rather, it is like the line in an old Japanese poem. I don't know if the autumn will bring rain or storm. Still, I shall pull the weeds in the rice paddy. So apparently rain and storm can just completely decimate a rice crop, just ruin it if it happens at the wrong time. That may happen, but he's pulling the weeds in the rice paddy. So, to return to that Rose versus Violet thing for a moment, I guess I want to throw out, what does real acceptance of ourselves feel like? You know, there's always a tension between our aspiration to be, to live with greater wisdom and compassion and skillfulness. That is part and parcel of our practice as well, right? This is definitely not about, I'm good enough as I am. That's just the way I am, take it or leave it. So that's not what it's about. So what does this real acceptance feel like? And I mean, perhaps there are moments in your life where you have, for one reason or another, it came together and you got a piece of this self-acceptance. What does it feel like when it's appropriate? Oh, Mark, you're still muted.
I think about freedom and intimacy.
Hmm. Hmm.
I think about peace, serenity, ease.
And that ease, even about now you recognize you're a violet and not a rose.
Yeah, and that's okay.
Think about wholeness. And the way that some of the toughest parts are to accept are the parts where you're in conflict. But acceptance can accept being in conflict as well.
I think I like the word wholeness because I think a lot of the times you feel incomplete when you don't just like accept yourself for who you are, you're looking for something else. And then when you find that recognition that you feel more complete, you're whole as is. You don't need to look for something that's not there.
I think for me, there's an element of comfort in that. I guess when I'm in pain, I need to be able to, or the wholeness for me is being able to give myself enough love to get through that pain without either being consumed by it or, I don't know, it's hard to explain exactly, but essentially like, yeah, give myself healthy love, like comfort, that kind of thing.
I think of two things. One is gratitude, and the other is that I'm not really there.
Maybe that's a little like what he was saying, that it's rose or violet, it's not something fixed.
It's like that's not even an arising. It's not even a consideration. It's just it's just kind of a whole, it's just kind of a beingness, but literally, I mean, it's as if I, maybe that's a small, I just isn't there. I don't know how to word it, sorry.
I think for me, I had a interesting experience a couple of weeks ago. I started work at a new school in a new district, and I didn't know anyone, and I had to go to my first department meeting to meet, you know, the 12 people I'm going to work with. And I'm not the most social of people, and everyone else already knew everyone, so they're all talking and chatting, and normally in a situation like that, I would have felt really uncomfortable. But I ended up just kind of sitting there. It was a nice day. It was before all the fires started. And I was just kind of enjoying the morning. And then it sort of snuck up on me that I was perfectly fine with not participating and socializing. And I wasn't self-conscious about not fitting in and not talking to people. And so I think when he talks a little bit about that, you know, not worrying if you're a violet or a rose, not even thinking about if you're a violet or a rose. I think that sometimes that acceptance can sneak up on us. Mm. And I think it's sometimes when we're most accepting of ourselves, we may not even be aware that we're most accepting of ourselves because we're so grounded in whatever we're doing at that time. We're just there.
Yeah. I always love the violet and the rose thing because I mean, you just think about, like, what would the world be without violets? We want all the flowers to look like roses? You know, that'd be terrible. Then roses wouldn't be special anyway if they were all like roses. So he goes on, you know, talking about you have to be careful not to misinterpret self to mean a kind of self-centeredness or false individualism. Well, I'm going to talk about that later in a moment, actually. So he's talking about that present, which contains a certain direction, you know, wherein you prepare tomorrow's gruel as tonight's work. So that's what we talked about last week. You know, how we can be fully present and not attached to results, you know, being in we're on a course, we have a direction, we've chosen a direction, but then we can kind of let go of what might happen or what should happen. And just in this moment, that's, you know, whatever it is that we need to be doing next is this moment's work. So this chapter, I feel like is taking that a little bit deeper and saying, how do we pick that direction? How do we choose? This is called, the chapter is called Making Life Calculations, you know, so it's, again, it's about that kind of direction. What are we choosing to do with our lives? And he talks about, on page 67, to live out the life of the capital S self, always be in the present and always where you are, is neither to shut yourself up inside some small egotistical shell trying to escape the world, nor to become enraptured in some stilted world of Zen. We have to exhaust all of our effort to manifest and actualize eternity at this point where our capital S self encounters all matters here and now, and to devote ourselves to move in that direction whereby the whole world becomes settled within itself. The practice of the Buddhas is carried on together with the whole world and with all sentient beings. If it is not a practice together with all things, it is not the practice of the Buddhas. Therefore, from the time we first aspire to the way until we attain enlightenment, both practice and attainment must be carried on with the whole world and all sentient beings. So practicing for the sake of the whole world and all sentient beings. What does that mean? It certainly means opening our heart, bearing witness. He says, you know, so we're not shutting ourselves into our egotistical shell. And what is it, what does this feel like? And this is, I think, fairly subtle. So I think of going out to garden. I have a yard that I, over the past 5 years, I've transformed from grass to native plants, and it's wild and weedy and got wood debris all over it, and it's been certified as a backyard bird habitat. So when I go out and take care of it, I can be gardening, if you will, for my own sake, for my own sense of satisfaction and seeing how it looks, and my own sense of achievement, in my own enjoyment of the moment, my own sense of restoration. Maybe I'm also growing some vegetables. I'm growing some vegetables to eat. So it can be pretty just much about me or my family or my home, my personal life. So what does it mean for me to garden for the sake of the whole world and all sentient beings? What does it mean to, as he says, your true self includes the world you live in. Both practice and attainment must be carried on with the whole world and all sentient beings. So what is it like? What can I garden and hold Jacob Blake and his family and community in my heart as I garden? Can I garden and include the fact that the redwoods are burning because of global heating? How can I hold that in my heart now as I interact with Sangha and try to be present in a meaningful way and share some Zen teachings? And there's no way to describe this in adequately in words, you know? This is an energetic, experiential thing. So I want to just open it up then and ask that, what about, how do we go about our activities, our work, in a way that includes the whole world and all sentient beings? That's an easy question. Come on. <I'm> joking.
Sometimes I think it means sometimes doing with full presence, doing what needs to be done instead of doing what you feel like doing at the moment. You know, you might, I might need to make phone calls urging people to mail in ballots early, when I'd rather be out gardening, for example. But with a sense of ease still, being present and okay with it, even if I'm not doing what I personally would rather be doing at the moment.
For some reason, before you started talking about your garden and your yard, I was thinking about being in my garden, which is a community garden, and I happen to walk in a community garden area today, not my own, but in other communities, with Curly, as we were talking about at the beginning. And this might make me just a little bit emotional, but I've had conversations before with people who don't understand the love of an animal or love for an animal. And, you know, I thought about this as Curly and I had to cross a busy street, very busy street, to get back home, and how I had to look out to get across the street safely myself, as well as to get him across. All of a sudden, it was not about me. It was about us getting across the street safely. And in my own garden, you know, it's starting to be a disappointing time. Because, okay, the monarchs are done. I'm not going to get a monarch this year. Like I knew I wasn't going to, but then you keep looking and, you know, the roses are, I'll probably get another bunch of blooms maybe before October. I hope I do. But you know, when I'm there, it's not about my bushes and my little butterfly garden. It's about all the activity that's going on in that place with the owner of the property, and he's there and his dog and other people gardening and bees, so many pollinators. So I feel like I'm taking a long time to answer. It feels like a holistic feeling, like everything is going on. And I'm a part of it, but I'm not the center of it. And so to hold some of the tragic things that continue to go on in the world, as I'm in the garden, as an example, or as I'm crossing the street with Curly, it's almost like what we do in Zazen. It goes through my mind, it's there, I acknowledge it, and then I let it go because something else is going to come along behind it, either in a moment or in a few moments or something. I don't know if that made me sense. It sure made sense to me.
Yeah. I thought about writing a poem about this because, it's hard to describe it in just ordinary prose. But I'm imagining most of you have some kind of sense of, you know, it's possible to do an activity one way, you know, kind of self-centered, this, go to they say, self-centeredness or false individualism, it's all just kind of about me. And then this doing the same activity in a very different way.
Yeah, that's, I'm glad you said that, because for me, that's, I've recently re-engaged with playing music after a lot of years of kind of doing it on and off, but I've really kind of committed to this idea of music as a language, and I want to get to a point technically where essentially I'm the vessel that just lets it pass through. And sometimes every once in a while that happens, but it's pretty rare. And And so I think this is a really, music for me is a really good example of this, what you're talking about, because it can be very ego-driven. You can compare yourself to other people. You can think, oh, I suck, or oh, I'm great, this, that, the other thing. But at the end of the day, I think, like most art, I think it's it becomes just sort of like this, it's a very Zen concept, I think. You just become this vehicle for expression. That's my goal with it. And I don't think I actually put that together until you just said that. So thanks for that.
Yeah, Tyler.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if my internet connection is really wonky right now, so hopefully I'm okay. I think I really love gardening, and I had sort of a lot of thought about that, but I think also when we work with kids is the other thing I do a lot. Often it's kind of easier if you have your goals for which you are, or it feels easier if you have your goals for which you are going to put onto those kids for them to complete, like a preschool or whatever, you know, this is the craft you're going to do, and I'm going to help you do it, and it's going to look really good, and your parents are going to be really excited when they get home, but really it's just me doing these crafts for the kids, or you know, like that's sort of like a way that you see a lot of teaching being done. But when you can pull back and say, okay, I'm going to take myself and my needs out of this and really truly focus on what the needs of the child is in that moment. Maybe they don't need to do a damn craft, right? Maybe they're losing their mind. Like they don't need to, you know, I don't need to be pushing them in any particular agenda throughout the day. And so really it can be hard to take yourself and your ego out of what you think your school should be and the kids should be doing and the way they should be acting. And really being like, what do they actually need right now? Because maybe they just need to run on screaming for the day, and that's just what they need. And people walk by my school and think we're nuts, and that's okay. That, you know, they're watching and that sort of thing. So I think, yeah, taking my own self out of working with kids is a kind of a daily way of making sure that sort of thing is going on.
I like it.
I think Tyler and Franklin kind of are touching on what I was saying earlier, was that I'm not really there at those times. And I think maybe another way for me to describe it is there are times when I can be doing something and I can feel that my energy is up high in my body and I can be very myopically focused. And the more grounded I am in my body, the less I'm really or less this ego me really exists, where Franklin was using the word vessel, and the less bounded I am, the more boundless I am. So I think for me, that's the difference of how I hold the space. If the energy's up and there's actually more of me present, there's more of my ego present, it's more myopic. And if I'm more grounded, I have less boundaries and I'm less present. My ego is less there involved. It's just more of a global connection and expansion as long as when I'm grounded.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, another way to phrase this is that this is about to, if we're working toward including the whole world and all sentient beings in our life and practice, that is about changing our sense of self, recognizing the emptiness of self, or to use the other word, the boundlessness of self. Like Uchiyama Roshi is saying, everything we encounter is ourself. So, you know, that there's that contracted sense of, you know, I'm over here, but there's ourself is all of these things we encounter. A really beautiful part here, he says, the whole world and all sentient beings does not infer spatial magnitude or number. So we immediately think like, oh yeah, I'm going to include, like mentally take stock of all the, but in a way this isn't even, I mean, it is, you know, there, I do have a sense of spaciousness when there's a, where in that boundlessness is I allowed to be. But there also is that really, you know, there's another aspect to this of, I guess it's tied to the Bodhisattva vow. I mean, how does the whole world and all sentient beings enter into not just this moment by moment experience, which he says, in this same way, living now does not mean a directionless living for the moment. So how does the whole world and all sentient beings enter into the direction of your life? So in this very moment, we can have this sense of kind of boundlessness and spaciousness and inclusiveness, you know, immediate response. But then, you know, we're talking about in these last 2 weeks also about kind of direction. And we have this function because this is based on the Tenzo Kyokan, which has very specific directions for how to prepare the meals for the community, nutritious meals that have certain kinds of tastes and flavors on time, you know, using the ingredients given. So in that sense of like, how does the all world and all sentient beings enter into the direction of our lives? What are we doing to take care of the whole world and all sentient beings? How do we enact the fact that our true self includes the world we live in? The fact that the present includes both future and past? How do we avoid what Uchiyama calls that self-centeredness or false individualism, or that directionless living for the moment? So if you're like me, when you contemplate these questions, you know, you think about whether or not you spend time engaged in activities to make the world a better place beyond the confines of your personal sphere of existence. Activities to benefit the world you live in and all sentient beings, because it's all part of yourself. And if you're involved in these kinds of activities, that's one thing. If you're not, or you don't think you're as involved as you should be or could be, you might think about how such activities, whatever comes to mind, are too demanding or don't really help anyway, or you just haven't found the right thing to do. But I'm wondering whether this comes back to recognizing and accepting whether we're a rose or a violet or a dandelion or a dahlia or a showy milkweed or a hyacinth. What are we capable of and what is ours to do? And then when we engage in the work, having chosen what we think is a good direction, making life calculations as necessary, and doing all of this work as the work of this moment, without reliance on results, without it being dependent on the future. We have decided, you know, I mean, my example, which many of you are aware of already, you know, I've searched for many, many years to find something that I thought I could do, I wanted to do, that I thought would be useful. And I found Extinction Rebellion. So now I spend a lot of time working on that. And is it really going to change anything? I don't know. I hope so. Like I chose the thing that I thought was, I'd made my best choice, right? But now I just do the work. And there's something so satisfying about having made a life calculation that includes, you know, the whole world and all sentient beings. And now I can kind of it feels satisfying for the life direction and goal to include all sentient beings. And I think there is a way that all of us have already in our lives, whether it's an explicit thing like Extinction Rebellion or not, there's been ways that things we have chosen to do, ways we've chosen to live, emphases we've chosen, that in order to include the whole world and all sentient beings. So that is my question for you for a short
question. I've missed the question in all of that.
How do you include the whole world and all sentient beings in your life and practice? And I mean that to be very, very open. So I might put you in little breakouts. And I'll type the question in to the chat so you can have it. Let's see. All right. Any cool things that you've heard in your breakout room that you want to share in our last few minutes?
Yeah, we had a kind of an interesting ending discussion on the word interference. And I don't consider it to be interfering to be interacting with somebody and to do something that is necessary. For instance, if they had some healthcare need that needs to be done, I don't call that interference. And YT was talking about it as interference, and I don't see it that way. It's just a flow of from one moment to the next. But if I'm constantly making a decision that says, should I be doing this or not, then I have actually interfered with it in some way.
So actually how I had started was I had used the word a responsiveness to the environment.
That's better.
Yeah, that's how I started. And I think this is getting a little off because then you had mentioned something and then Mark said to you, well, why wouldn't you interfere? And so I was trying to clarify for me, using the word interference depends upon how you're using it. So for me, it's still about a responsiveness. That it's not just sitting back in awareness and doing nothing. That there are times that in that responsiveness, I need to step up and do something.
That's what I call the flow.
I heard something sweet in our room about pointing out how, you know, in a given moment, you might be, at a given time, you might be doing something that you have chosen to benefit, you know, that you it's your best guess that this would be of benefit to the world, and this is what, that's what you're engaging in. But then at other times, you know, it's not time for that activity, right? Then you're taking care of your life, you're taking care of yourself, but in a way that can also be done with this attitude that it is all still, you know, for all beings and with all beings. So even when we are just like doing our own thing, it can be done with that more open attitude. Or at least that's my paraphrase of what I heard.
Very good.
All right, well, that makes it 9 o'clock, or I should stop saying times, right? That means we are at our time, which in different time zones means different things. So I'll close with a dedication. We dedicate the merit of this practice together to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Good night.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks. Good night.